Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Talk about me, babe. If you must, throw out the dirt, pile on the dust. I'd do the same thing if I could. You know what they say. They say it's all good. All good. It's all good.
He's one of the titans of popular music, but some say, Bob Dylan, it may be time to retire. Welcome to Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. We'll debate Dylan as his latest album comes out today, and later in the hour, a visit with Wendy and Lisa, the duo that most know as part of Prince and the Revolution. When historians look back on the epic career of Bob Dylan, his 33rd album, called Together Through Life, probably won't rank beside the masterpieces like Blowin' in the Wind or like a Rolling Stone. Still, the collection of 10 mostly bluesy numbers is earning high marks from fans and many critics. They say Dylan's having a creative renaissance. His ragged voice is the perfect vehicle for simple, stripped-down songs like this one. Others aren't convinced. They argue that Dylan has run out of things to say, and he's resorted to appropriating blues standards and giving erratic live performances. Today, we'll settle it, asking the question, who was better, the Dylan of the 60s or the Dylan of today? It's our regular weekly
Soundcheck Smackdown.
And joining me in the studio to champion the Bob Dylan of today is Joe Levy, the editor of Maxim magazine and former editor of Blender and Rolling Stone magazines. And joining us on the line to argue for the classic Dylan, the Dylan of the 60s, is Bill Wyman, editor of the blog Hitsville and former arts editor of NPR and Salon.com. Bill, Joe, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill, let me start with you. You told us earlier that I haven't heard a great song on it, referring to the new Bob Dylan record. There's a lot of great songs in the guy's catalog. Are you holding him to a higher standard than you would anybody else who's just put out an album?
That's funny you'd ask that, because that's exactly the question for the other side. The question is he putting out great songs? When I get a record, this is a very crude indication. But you get a record, you listen to it, is there a song on it? You'd sit down with a friend, say, hey, isn't this a great new song on this Bob Dylan record? In the last, decade or 12 years, he's put out 3 or 4 records. Time Out of Mind, I think anyone could listen to Lovesick and say that's a sensational song, Not Dark Yet. Some people like Mississippi on, I think that's on Love and Theft. And then after that, you really get to the point of saying, is there a song you put on a mixtape for a friend? Is there a song you play on a radio show to introduce someone to the more recent Dylan? I just don't hear it. I don't have anything against him. I think he's an amazing guy, and it was an epic career, of course. And he's got his other things creatively going on that I think are sometimes overlooked. But as far as putting out records that deserve to be played on the radio and that you'd stick on in your house or your car, I don't hear them.
Joe, is there a record here that you would put on a mixtape for a friend? Or?
Yeah, apparently Bill and I have different friends, but and some in common too. Let's say that. I'd put songs on this for friends on mixtapes and on Modern Times as well. I've got to say, Modern Times, it's funny to say there's not a great song or a song people talked about. That's the one that opens up with Thunder on the Mountain, where he talks about, I'm thinking about Alicia Keys. Everybody thought that was hilarious. And it ended up as a talked about song, and a song that people sat down and listened to and talked about, in some cases, even if you weren't a Dylan fan, because it was so funny. Dylan is the reverse of Woody Allen. The later Dylan is a lot funnier, in point of fact, than early Dylan. And early Dylan was pretty funny at times. But the later Dylan is vaudeville funny. It's shtick funny. It's Groucho Marx funny. And on these last 3 records in particular, the new one, Together Through Life, Love and Theft, Modern Times, the man has developed a comic timing and sense of humor that didn't seem to be there before. It's notable. It's worth listening to, and it's one of the things that does get people to trade some of these songs, sit down and talk about them, put them on mixtapes. I'd even say there are songs on the new record. We were playing one when you intro'd the show, It's All Good, a song that a lot of people on this record have already talked about. Because it is so sardonic, it arrives at a time when people feel nothing is good. And I think that it's weirdly one of the most talked about songs that he's recorded in quite a while.
So, Bill, the idea that there is this, you know, that this sense of humor was sort of lurking beneath the angry young man and now is coming out in this kind of snarky older man, does that ring true to you?
Well, I agree. I totally agree that he was funny in the 60s. I mean, this is one of the most explosively nuclear level, sardonic and sarcastic and amused artists of the 20th century. And to bring it down to today, to say that, oh, saying it's all good, used ironically, I'm not saying it's not it's not a terrible song. I'm not saying it's a terrible song or anything like that, but I think we're talking about Pretty Warm Beer. And one of the things that happens with him, I think, is that, like, this new record, when I listen to it, it's perfectly adequate. It's actually better in a lot of ways. I don't think there's any good songs on it, but, you know, it's these basically adequate, competently done blues numbers that he does. But we end up praising him just for putting out an adequate record, because we have to
remember, I really don't think
that
so.
He had a really bad decade back in the 80s, for example. When you talk about Knocked Out, Loaded, and Down in the Groove and some of that, where he really seemed to have lost his way, it's slightly better than that, I think. And I think we should talk about something else about his career, this thing of his having toured for the last 20 years, because I think that's where he's really found himself, and I think it's steadied himself. And now he's put out one pretty good Time Out of Mind, and then three other serviceable records over the space of 12 years, which is something he hadn't done since 1975. So I think we have to give him credit for that.
And I would say that Time Out of Mind,
he's been doing it live.
Yeah. And I wouldn't disagree with that entirely up until a point probably around 2000, 2001, maybe 2002. Mm-hmm. The Dylan live shows were remarkable from 97 to 2002. Absolutely remarkable. Around 2002, Dylan switches from guitar to keyboards, and the shows become a little less remarkable. But to say that he's done his best work on the road, I wouldn't really argue with that. I think it's really what he means to do. I don't think he has an interest in making records. Certainly not, Bill brought up, getting them on the radio earlier. Certainly he's not making records to get them on the radio. He's not making records to conquer the world. He said over and over again, a record is a snapshot of the moment. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the final picture. Fine. Here's the thing. Time Out of Mind, to me, is the least of the four records he's made. I certainly think around Love and Theft, when he starts producing himself, we see a different Dylan. A Dylan who is able to realize, work quickly, and realize the sound in his head. He is, according to the people who work with him, the engineers, the musicians who've talked about it, exacting in the studio now. What he describes in Chronicles, his autobiography, is always prodigious, never exact. That is a quote about making the first of his records with Daniel Lanois, Time Out of Mind was the second, where they cut song after song after song, looking for the way, trying to find the way. Now, you have a record like Love and Theft, 12 songs, 12 days. That's what it took to get that record. I'll say this much for what Bill is saying. He is not working in a startling original way. He's not working in startling original forms. He does not mean to. This is a guy who has become like the bluesmen he worshipped when he was young. He is now like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf in their 60s. And God bless him, he's going to make it into his 70s, which those guys didn't.
Go ahead, Bill.
And it doesn't matter.
Bill?
Right, Joe, and that's a great point, because he said that, didn't he, in his second or third record. He says, I don't act like those guys. I don't walk like those guys yet, but I hope to someday.
Right.
And I think, crucially, he wants to die with his boots on the road. And I can't even really make the argument that he's making his best work on the road, just that it is quite a statement to kind of get up one summer day in 1988, put together a small combo, and start playing songs out of his catalog, and basically keep doing it for 21 years. I forget, I haven't been keeping up the last couple of years, but I think he's been playing 100 or 120 shows a year for 21 years.
That sounds about right. Also,
it's crazy. I mean, he's played more shows than than the Rolling Stones and Bruce Springsteen and U2 and whoever else combined.
And he's played some really unusual places. I mean, you know, it's not just, you know, the big arenas and the big towns, but like these little clubs and casinos.
Talk about when he played for the Pope.
The Pope.
He did play for the Pope.
This doesn't get talked about either, but he's kind of a little nuts, I think. He doesn't really have a home. He goes to towns now. His manager calls up the promoter and says, Bob wants to play in three places he's never played before. I think one thing I always forget, I always remember, is that in the Bay Area, they booked him in the business school auditorium at UC Berkeley once because they didn't have any other place to play. And that costs a lot of money to be in a city for 3 or 4 days and then move your show to one venue after another. He's very odd. And I think that there's some really interesting psychological things going on with him that he basically, I don't know, you do 120 shows, maybe you're on the road for 200 days. That's a pretty big chunk of any year to not be home.
That's Bill Wyman. He's editor of the blog Hitsville and former arts editor at NPR and Salon.com. He's on the line. Joe Levy, the editor-in-chief at Maxim, is with me in the studio, and we're debating Bob Dylan, old versus new, and here is a bit of classic Dylan from the 60s.
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
Bob Dylan, the times, they are a-changin'. Fast forward 4 decades, and the latest Bob Dylan record has this song called Beyond Here Lies Nothing.
We'll keep on loving pretty baby for as long as love will last. Beyond here lies nothing but the mountains of the past.
All right, now, the first time I heard this new song from Bob Dylan, it struck me as sounding eerily familiar, and it took the second go-round before it occurred to me, it sounds like this.
That she's a black magic woman, she's trying to make a devil out of me. Don't turn your back on me, baby.
And all the heads in the control room are nodding. Joe Levy, it's the same chord sequence. It's the same turnaround, break.
That's because Fleetwood Mac, who wrote Black Magic Woman, right, based it on the same Howlin' Wolf song that Bob Dylan based Beyond Here Lies Nothing on. And the amazing thing is that the first and last song of this new record are both based on the same Howlin' Wolf song. Look, he's not making any bones about it.
But he is, in a sense, because he credits Willie Dixon.
He
doesn't credit anybody.
He credits
else.
Willie Dixon because Willie Dixon successfully sued Led Zeppelin.
That.
And if you don't credit Willie Dixon, his estate is going to sue you. Does he credit Memphis Minnie for the song he took from her last time out? No. Does he credit Muddy Waters for Someday Baby, which is based on Trouble in Mind or Trouble No More? I forget which it's called. He has to credit the Muddy Waters song he rips off for My Wife's Hometown. Rips off is a judgmental word, takes.
Mm-hmm.
Takes, bends the words to, writes all new words to this time, as opposed to Rollin' and Tumblin', which is actually the name of the Muddy Waters song that Rollin' and Tumblin' on the last Bob Dylan song was based on, last Bob Dylan record was based on. Look, he's not hiding it, is my point. You record a song called Rollin' and Tumblin'. It's the exact same song as a Muddy Waters song called Rollin' and Tumblin'. You change the words. What you're saying is, what I do is take a tradition. These songs have authors, but they were hand-me-downs in the first place. They come from a blues tradition that's based on an oral tradition that exists before copyright. And that's what I do. It's what I've always done.
Mm-hmm.
His name is on Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. But hey, he got that from a traditional song he learned from a Cambridge folkie named Eric von Schmidt, and he got the words from another song, I even forget which, but you can see some guy singing it in the Scorsese documentary.
So,
you know, he's appropriated before. In the great David Hajdu book, Positively 4th Street, there's a scene of Dylan writing, and if I remember right, he's at a desk with coffee wine, cigarettes, maybe a joint, the newspaper, and the Bible. And he goes around the circle until he has a song. The guy's a magpie, and he always has been. He's not hiding it here.
And certainly not the only one, yeah.
He's a musical scholar, a non-pro musical scholar among artists of his stature. I don't think anyone would deny that his knowledge just it permeates a century of music. My problem with that song is that it's samey. Because he doesn't have a producer, no producer says, get out of that single groove that keeps nagging at you. This is one of my big complaints about a lot of his songs. The Houston song is a good example. And
Bill, can I just, let's just explain. You've both alluded to this. The album is produced by Jack Frost.
This is the pseudonym that Dylan has used to produce himself over the last three records.
Right.
Yeah.
So just for people who have the record and are saying, what are they talking about? It's produced by Jack Frost. That is Dylan. I don't know how many pseudonyms a single guy needs, but Bob Dylan apparently was not enough of one, so now he's Jack Frost as well. So go ahead, Bill.
And I forget which record in the 80s that said this record could have been produced by someone. And so whenever Dylan doesn't have a producer, with disastrous results, and disastrous results always result when Dylan produces himself. But a lot of these songs, they have this samey guitar line that goes, Dan-air. Dan it, and it goes through 4.5 minutes of the song, and no one in the studio says, "Can we just do a change up somewhere, Bob?" No one, because people can't confront him, and he sets himself up in a way where people don't confront him, and I don't think he's an artist who should be producing himself.
All right, let's take a few calls. We'll get some other voices and opinions on the Smackdown today. We want to know what you think. Is the Dylan of today just as good as his classic self of the 60s? Is it time that he called it quits? Our number is 212-433-WNYC. Or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. Kay joins us from North Brunswick, New Jersey. Kay, which is the better Dylan, 60s or noughts, or whatever we're calling this decade?
Oh, I like the guy. He's great. He's wonderful. And the fact that critics have been criticizing him since day one is funny. Remember, guys, he started out, that whole sound in the 60s was like reminiscent of Arlo Guthrie and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about the 80s, and there was an album where he came out with Gospel, this Jewish curly-haired boy. And it was a wonderful album. And on there was a song, You Gotta Serve Somebody. I got it on my iPod. You know what?
You know, Kay, that's really interesting.
I like the artists and how they do things, and he doesn't do things on the straight track with all the rest, and he doesn't do things that even a lot of musicians do, which is experiment. Always. Whether it's somebody else's material, somebody else's words, he's always bringing things to light. The difference here is you guys are sitting on the sideline. I mean, you're so much on the sideline. I'd like to know what you've been doing.
Well, I'll tell you one thing.
Criticism.
I'll tell you one thing I was doing this morning, Kay, was we were sitting in our sort of staff meeting and, thinking about how Joe, you were going to be sort of defending modern Dylan Joe and Bill defending the classic Dylan of the 60s. And I was wondering if there would be, in fact, anybody to stand up for the Dylan of the 80s, which, you know, so many people consider to be kind of a lost decade. Bill, you said before, he sounded like he had lost his way.
Yeah,
during...
there are a couple of one of the things he did with Slow Train Coming is periodically he goes to a good producer, someone who actually knows how to record a record, to write himself. And then you had these crazy records that followed Saved and Shot of Love, and then a real disaster in the late 80s. But the idea of the caller said that critics are mean to Dylan is just crazy. I mean, one of the interesting constructs of journalism these days is that negative reviews, particularly for pop records, are almost non-existent. I mean, I can't remember Dylan getting a bad review hardly anywhere. There was a little blurb in the New Yorker the other day where the new Dylan record in Rolling Stone only got 4 stars. And so in the context of Bruce Springsteen always getting 4 stars and et cetera, 5 stars, it was big news that Bob Dylan for once didn't get 5 stars. So the idea that people pick on Dylan is just crazy. And in fact, what they do is they keep saying, oh, he's getting better and better, when patently he's not.
G from New York writes on the Soundcheck page, would the people who argue for the Dylan of the 60s actually have liked Dylan in the 60s? I mean, was his reputation back then kind of was it kind of out of sync with the way that the critics were responding to him back in the day?
Go ahead, Joe.
No. I mean, yeah, people, look, Dylan in the 60s is venerated. Dylan owned the 60s.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to argue against Dylan in the 60s. You know, Dylan in the 60s, I mean, honestly.
So are you saying that the Dylan now is somehow, not that he's better, but that he's different, he's just as good, but just in, perhaps in a different...
I would say it's a continuum. You know, okay. What's fascinating about the Dylan of the 60s and the Dylan now is that, look, the voice is more ragged, but he was a young man trying to sound like an old man. You know, what we know from certain moments where he stepped out from behind that growl, Nashville Skyline, say, where he, you know, he sang in a more straight voice without the gravel in it. We know that he was making an effort to sound like an old man, like a man out of time. All of these Dylan references about time are all about wanting to be outside it. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Time really means, God is on our side. You know, where he says, you know, my name, it means nothing. You know, his identity, his point is he just wants to be part of this continuum of American song. That's principally what about his work over these last three records is about. It's about laying claim to that continuum, specifically pre-rock music,
which
blues
is,
and pre-rock pop. You know that all
Zydeco,
of those.
Like there's a little.
There's Mexican. There's Mexican accordion on this record, but before that, the real change in Love and Theft in Modern Times and this record are these dance hall style ballads, where he lays claim to a kind of pre-rock pop, sometimes lifting the bridge of a song from a Johnny Mercer song, sometimes going back to some weird Paris dance hall jazz music, you know, and his band has talked about this. They would get on stage and sound check Dean Martin songs over and over again to get
or
the
Moon
sound
River
right.
Or
something Moon River
like that.
And then go into the studio and Dylan would say to them, I want to record something like a Billie Holiday song.
Right.
And they would go like, oh, that's what we've been doing. We've been learning how to play that music so that when we get here, we can spit out the Dylan version of it.
Joe Levy is editor-in-chief at Maxim. Bill Wyman's with us as well, editor of the blog Hitsville, formerly arts editor at NPR. We're debating Bob Dylan, old and new. He's got this new album out called Together Through Life, and we'll continue our conversation, our Soundcheck Smackdown debate on Bob Dylan in just a moment. From Dylan's 1980 album Saved, which, this period maligned by some, but still fiercely protected by other Dylan fans. We'll talk more about Bob Dylan in a moment, and coming up later, Wendy and Lisa were key members of Prince's band, The Revolution, in the 80s. More recently, they've worked on music for the NBC hit series Heroes, and they'll talk about scoring, or rescoring, a 1937 radio drama later on Soundcheck.
Far off into the east, and I see my baby coming. She's walking with the village priest.
Bob Dylan does mariachi on his new record, Together Through Life. It also blends folk, Tin Pan Alley style pop, Americana, Southern blues. We're debating today whether the Dylan of today matches the Dylan of the 60s in our weekly Soundcheck Smackdown. In the studio with me is Joe Levy, editor of Maxim magazine, who is a proponent of the modern Bob Dylan, the Dylan of modern times, both the modern times literally and the record of that name. And on the line to argue for the Dylan of the 60s is Bill Wyman, editor of the blog Hitsville. And also joining us on the line, Scott in Yonkers. Scott, we were talking about all the different styles that Dylan sort of takes from in Together Through Life. He's done this sort of thing before, right? And you have a particular record that you would point to.
Well, my favorite Dylan record is Nashville Skyline.
Why?
And I've never quite understood why people thought like Blonde on Blonde was better than that. Blonde on Blonde has a lot of great songs. I don't think the entire album is great. I think it's one of those albums that would have made a better single disc than a full disc. But I love the Dylan of the 70s, Nashville Skyline. I love his work with the band on Before the Flood, which I think was around 74. Nashville Skyline was actually the very late 60s, but came out, I think, in 1970. I love Hurricane. I think that's one of his greatest things. I'm a little surprised that everybody here is overlooking the 70s.
I'm not sure that we're actually overlooking them. I guess it's more a question of, comparing Dylan to the huge shadow that 60s Dylan casts. And, Joe, I mean, that's the big thing that you, defending modern Dylan, are up against, isn't it?
It's right. And the amazing thing about Dylan now is that we can have this discussion. You know, there is no other artist in his 60s whose work merits this kind of discussion in rock and roll. Now, I would say Love and Theft, the best rock guitar record the guy made since Blonde on Blonde. And that's amazing that many years later, he puts together a kick-ass rock guitar band that gives him that kind of sound. Now, it's the same rock guitar sound based on blues, soul, based on the folk, the country music that he loves, twisted in his way. And there is no other artist, not the Stones, not the Who, whose live work remains remarkable, who we can have this kind of debate over.
And, Scott mentioned this record, Nashville Skyline. Turns out a couple of other commenters have either written in or called in to mention this record as well. Here's a little bit of it.
It curls and falls all down her breast. See for me that her hair's hanging down. That's the way I remember her best.
And of course, I got out of the way just in time for Johnny Cash to be the one singing on Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline. Guys, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was just going to say, when people talk about the Dylan of the 60s, I think, in a very clumsy way, I think we're all talking about up until Blood on the Tracks and Desire. I think most people would say up until 75, 76, with a kind of weird spot there around the Self-Portrait era, he was putting out pretty consistently extraordinary stuff for a 15-year period, which began, incidentally, with a rave in the New York Times in 1961, which we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of in about 18 months or so, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to give him credit for a good 15 years of pretty much unparalleled, extraordinary creativity.
All right, guys, let me mention to both of you, bring up one other topic, which is the presence on this new record of Robert Hunter. I mean, here is like the great lyricist in Bob Dylan, one of the great lyricists of popular music of the last half century. Why does he have another lyricist, the guy who famously wrote with Jerry Garcia for the Grateful Dead, helping out with the words here?
I personally think that we're talking about this amazing Dylan, the contrarian, iconoclastic, just put a thumb in your eye type Dylan, which is why occasionally he sells one of his songs to an advertising agency to be used in a dumb commercial, which is why he is so contrarian and always undermines expectations. Again, you go back to Down in the Groove when he was writing with Carol Bayer Sager and Robert Hunter and stuff like this. The idea, with the exception of Jacques Levy, who he did a lot of Desire with, who I think really helped narrow him and focus him, it's just one of these crazy things he would do. But at the other hand, you also have to point out that if this is a guy who's one of our great songwriters who's looking for lyrical help, you're not thinking of a guy who's at the top of his powers.
I would disagree. I think that the idea of using Robert Hunter here is because Hunter is someone who loves traditional music as much as Dylan does and who can take that traditional music and help him bend it in the way he wants to bend it now. Now, look, we all know the examples that have been cited on the last few records, the Civil War poet who he lifted from, the book about the Japanese mob that he lifted from. He's been looking for inspiration wherever he wants. The title of this record comes from James Joyce's letters to his wife, Nora, as does the immortal line, "You're as whorish as ever, you could start a fire." Also lifted from one of James Joyce's love letters to his wife.
So why does he need Robert Hunter for when he's got James?
Because
and
Hunter
Dylan.
Was around, and apparently, I don't know, they were splitting a bottle of wine or something else, I would imagine. And because this record was actually made quickly and on a lark, he went into the studio to cut a single song for a soundtrack. He stayed in cutting music and came up with a record faster than anyone knew what to do with it. This record follows a 2 or 3 CD set, if you bought the deluxe edition, of outtakes that came out just a few months ago last year. The record company wasn't expecting a new Dylan record. They were expecting one song for a soundtrack. He went in, he cut a blues album. It's a good blues album.
It's a really good record, in many ways.
It's more consistent than the last record and more consistent than records in the 60s. That are more venerated.
All right, let me get one more caller in, guys, before we wrap up here. Bob in Manhattan. Bob, are you a fan of the recent Dylan?
Well, yeah, I'm very interested in it. The thing that I call to point out is that there are commonalities in great artists' careers. You know, they reinvent themselves. When they get older, they tend to move faster and work in broader strokes. They incorporate other people's work to test themselves against the other greats. And there's a great show on now, and I'll say the name. It's Picasso. I mean, I rate Dylan up there with the greats with Picasso. Picasso did all those things. Dylan is doing all those things.
Right, and this is particularly a show of later period Picasso, much of which was maligned, dismissed, a derivative of his own work, stolen from other work, and it has come around now. People look at it with eyes years removed from the initial criticism, and they go, golly gee, that guy could paint.
All right. A final comment from Jeff in Queens, who I think is going to come down on Bill's side of the debate. He writes, I own both, most of the old Dylan and some of his newer things. That said, when I feel like listening to Dylan, there is nothing that kills me like the Dylan who sang and spewed Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat. The new Dylan is a nice old man. Well, I guess he can be a nice old man and still be the contrarian that I think both of you guys agree that he still is. We've been debating Bob Dylan, old and new. The new album is called Together Through Life. Joe Levy, the editor-in-chief of Maxim here in the studio. Bill Wyman, the editor of the blog Hitsville, on the line with us from Phoenix. Bill, Joe, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks,
Don. And I see my baby come up. She's walking with the village priest. I feel a change coming on.
And still to come, the duo Wendy and Lisa talk about their career from working with Prince to scoring movies, TV, and now a 1937 radio play. And Soundcheck wants you to help us define downtown, but you can only use a single word. Post your one-word definition on the Soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org, and then tune in tomorrow when we discuss the meaning of downtown in the arts in a live broadcast from WNYC's brand new Jerome L. Green Performance Space tomorrow.
I feel the change coming on, and the fourth part of the day is on.